The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
An article printed by the Odessa American on January 21, 1980, attempted to rationalize the increase in crime in the city of Odessa, Texas. Theft, burglary, physical assault, sexual assault, and murder rates had all risen substantially, most doubled, in fact, in the year 1979 compared to their numbers in 1970. Chief of Detectives for the Odessa Police Department, Jack Filyaw, gave a couple of his theories as to why. "There has been an awful lot of change in law enforcement in the last 25 years," Filyaw told the newspaper, adding, "Officers have to stay abreast of the changes and have to be careful to protect the defendant's rights. An officer has to be on his toes these days." Meaning, presumably, that beating a confession out of a suspect was much less of an option. Chief of Detectives Filyaw told the reporter that the main factor, the determining factor, in the increase in crime was simple, that it all, quote, boils down to a population increase. Since the murder rate was up 43% since the beginning of the decade, and Odessa's population had only grown by 14.9% in that same period of time, either Filyaw's math is lacking, or the modest increase in population came with a bevy of depraved killers. Whatever the case, it wasn't just Odessa that saw an increase in homicides. Neighboring cities and counties, too, were seeing a jump. West Texas in the late 1960s and throughout the 1970s was a hotbed for monstrous and senseless acts of violence. Even after two of the area's most depraved madmen, Johnny Meadows and Tommy Ray Neeland, were apprehended and incarcerated, there wasn't just one West Texas boogeyman. These are the stories of three women whose lives were taken by nameless and faceless killers. Upon his stepping down at the end of 1972, Ector County Sheriff Slim Gabriel bragged of his accomplishments as the county's top law enforcement officer. "We have solved more murders since I have been sheriff than ever before in Ector County," Gabriel told the Odessa American, adding, "We do not have a single outstanding unsolved murder." The city of Odessa, though, had several. The brutal stabbing murder of Ulamae Miller, detailed last episode, was as outstanding, as unfinished and unsolved as it gets. And the confessions to the murders of Linda Cougat and Ruth Maynard, too, had been thrown out by a court of law, ruled coerced. The Odessa police, though, even after that ruling, cleared those cases off their books. And another admission made by the same man, Johnny Meadows, just prior to the area's most bloody decade, was also thrown out in the neighboring city of Monahans after Meadows couldn't even get the details of that murder right in his confession and couldn't tell the police what he'd stolen or what he'd done with what he stole. And the circumstances of the murder of Anna Smith in Monahans are likely something her murderer wouldn't forget. Anna Helen Smith, who went by Dorothy, no second O, though the Odessa American and other newspapers would later misrepresent her name as Dorothy, was born in Watonga, Oklahoma, in 1903. Anna was never married and had only one sibling, a brother. It's unclear just why Anna Smith ended up in Monahans, Texas, a town about 30 miles southwest of Odessa. But she'd moved there around 1966 and seems to have done okay there as the owner and operator of the Western Courts Motel. Anna lived well. She was never strapped for cash, and she wore nice things. Those who knew Anna told reporters that they didn't even know if she was married or not. They said that she was quiet and rarely spoke of her personal life. That life was cut short on November 5th, 1968, when Monahan's police officers were dispatched to the Western Courts Motel at around 5:15 a.m. A tenant there was woken by what she thought to be a door slamming and loud thumping noises, and when she peeked through her curtains to check it out, she saw a man fleeing from the rear of the motel's office. He was white and stood about 5 feet 10 inches tall and was average weight, she told police, had dark hair, was clean-shaven, and wore a gold sweater with dark pants. The man fled in an easterly direction. When Monahan's police captain, Joe Dre, arrived just minutes after the call to police was made, he quickly discovered that rooms 5 and 6 had been broken into and attempted to phone the Western Courts Motel's office from the business just adjacent, Bob's Truck Stop. There was no answer. Captain Dre decided to enter the office and the connected apartment where the motel's owner lived and walked in on a terrible and bloody scene. Owner Anna Smith had been shot in the head, through her mouth, and laid on her back in a pool of blood on her bed. She was wearing silk pajamas. The 65-year-old woman had her hands tied in front with a television cord. Though the apartment had been ransacked, appearing to have been searched for valuables, there were no indications that a struggle had taken place. The perpetrator, whose motive would later be solidified as robbery, had no reason to kill Anna other than to silence the woman from exposing him. Anna's three large dogs were found loose, roaming the motel's property, and none of the guests reported hearing them bark at any time that night, suggesting to police that Anna knew her killer. An empty cash box was found in the apartment, and there was no shortage of rumors that Anna kept large sums of cash hidden in her apartment. At 7 a.m., an all-points bulletin was issued on the police band, telling officers in the area to keep an eye out for a man fitting the description the motel tenant had provided, and if such a person was stopped, he should be searched for a small caliber pistol, a watch, and a diamond ring. Those items, which Anna always wore, those who knew her said, were missing from her body, and a murder weapon hadn't been found on the scene. Anna's purse was also missing. Investigators weren't getting any breaks. The motel registry was missing, so they couldn't run down who was staying or had recently stayed at the Western Courts Motel. Another tenant at the motel witnessed a man that night standing behind Anna's apartment holding what looked like a rolled-up newspaper, but the sighting didn't provide additional details that helped the search for Anna's killer. No one saw the man flee by car, but a small television set was missing from Anna's room. But no one reported a man walking carrying a small television to police. Police checked out leads in Mesquite, Texas, where a hitchhiker was found who matched the description, loosely, of Anna's killer, but they couldn't keep him detained. They had no evidence at all that he had anything to do with the robbery and slaying of Anna Smith. In Hobbs, New Mexico, on Wednesday, November 6, 1968, a man described as blonde-headed and having a Texas accent robbed a Ramada Inn with a revolver. And though nothing is reported to have come from that lead, another clue led investigators to Hobbs too, when they discovered that a man who'd been registered at the Western Courts Motel in Monahans turned up there. Nothing came of that lead either, but it did suggest, perhaps, that police finally found the motel's registry. Until the murder of Eula Mae Miller in 1971, when Odessa's paranoia that a single madman was on the loose, the investigation into Anna Helen Smith's murder ceased to be covered in the press, and even after, the police had so little that any mention was nothing more than a blurb. Ballistics came back and confirmed that the caliber of bullet used to kill 65-year-old Anna was .38, and when Johnny Meadows later confessed, he claimed to have used a .32. Other details Meadows provided too didn't match, and his confession was thrown out. Perhaps the most interesting aspect of the Johnny Meadows confession debacle is the fact that fingerprints were collected at the scene of Anna's murder, and if Meadows were a match to any, it's likely he would have been scrutinized after his confession was deemed invalid. Regardless, if Monahan's police cleared her case as a result of the confession, the murder of Anna Helen Smith, also known as Dorothy, remains unresolved. The nature and circumstances of Anna's death were terrible, of course, and should never be minimalized, but many slayings in the upcoming decade in West Texas seemed to have far more sinister and mysterious motives than robbery.
Fall is a great time to set some new goals, get back into a healthy routine, and reprioritize yourself. Care of products can help you do just that. Care of is a wellness brand that makes it easy to get the right vitamins, supplements, and protein powders for your specific needs. You just take a short, fun, 5-minute quiz and answer easy questions about your diet, lifestyle, and health needs. Your Care of order gets shipped right to your door in convenient daily packs, perfect for a busy, on-the-go lifestyle. Just throw a couple in your suitcase when traveling or one in your bag on the way to the gym every morning. So it really is super easy and convenient. I keep the box of Care of vitamin packs on my desk, so when I'm starting my workday, I can just grab one of the little packs and it has my name on it and a quote or a little fact of the day to kind of make it more fun to take your vitamins each day. So when I grab one of those little packs each morning, I know that it has every daily vitamin that I need to reach my goals and to stay healthy throughout this cold weather. Care of also makes it easy to see where they source their ingredients from and ensure that you get only the highest quality products. So starting October 7th, 2019, for 25% off your first Care of order, go to takecareof.com and enter the promo code GONECOLD. That's takecareof.com and promo code GONECOLD for 25% off your first order. Bye, y'all!
On Saturday, September 1st, 1973, private practice attorney William Quackenbush began his run as Fort Stockton's police chief. Not only was Quackenbush ex-CIA, having served with that department the entirety of the 1950s, he also served 10 years as a Federal Bureau of Investigation special agent for most of the 60s and into the 70s. When he was diagnosed with a heart condition and high blood pressure in the early 70s, Quackenbush, along with his wife and daughter, decided that his time at the FBI was over, and the family decided that the small Texas town, Fort Stockton, was the perfect place to replant their roots. So, Quackenbush, along with a partner, set up a private practice there. "I need a quiet, sleepy little town," Quackenbush told the Odessa American, adding, "I had to slow down, take it a little easy." His practice became too much for him fast, though, too physically taxing, he said, but the longtime law enforcer didn't want to retire. As he contemplated his next move, the city offered him the job of police chief, and he jumped at it. "I decided it would be far less taxing than the law practice, and certainly 100 times less taxing than my job with the Bureau," Quackenbush said. The new chief declined to carry a gun at his side when he took the job at the 11-man department. In fact, he'd given up carrying a firearm years before when he was still in the FBI. Quackenbush didn't feel like he'd need one on his new watch either. The friendly, peaceful small town of Fort Stockton, where crimes like murder, a crime that the new chief, even with all his years in the FBI, had never investigated, were rare, and most often the result of drunken barroom altercations or domestic disputes that had gone too far. That's what Chief Quackenbush was riding on. However, only 3 days after he was sworn into office, his department got a call that shattered that notion. Born in Minnesota on March 17, 1930, 43-year-old widow Iris Elaine Neal had been living in Fort Stockton at the Gateway Lodge for 6 years since her husband, Pecos rancher Jim Neal, died of a heart attack. The Gateway Lodge was on Fort Stockton's main drag. It was a cheap motel, and the rooms had kitchenettes. They were essentially efficiency apartments intended for extended stays. Few in Fort Stockton knew Iris, but those who did considered her a generous person, always the first to offer a favor for someone in need. She was quiet and kept to herself. Iris wouldn't even allow the maids to come into her room to clean, the Gateway Lodge motel manager said of her. She disposed of her own trash and washed her own sheets. Iris had worked as a bartender at a Fort Stockton tavern, but in September of 1973, she was unemployed, presumably having been back to town for only a short period of time after an extended trip to El Paso, which she was known to do often. Several days before she was killed, Iris phoned a local lawyer, William Quackenbush, asking him to draw up a will for her. It wasn't an unusual request for the attorney, of course, but it was unusual for him that the call came at 2 or 3 in the morning. But for Iris, that was the norm. She slept during the day and was awake at night. But there was some behavior that those who knew Iris and her habits found out of character in the week leading up to Labor Day of 1973. The manager of the Gateway Motel reported that the woman had visited the motel's office on many late nights and early mornings to use the telephone there, and that she'd been acting nervous and distraught when doing so. On Monday, September 3rd, 1973, Labor Day, at about 5 p.m., Iris's cousin arrived at the Gateway Lodge to deliver some mail to her, parking just outside her room. This was, essentially, morning time for Iris, so her cousin became worried when her knocks went unanswered. After all, Iris's car was parked directly in front. When she realized her cousin wasn't going to respond, she began looking around and noticed Iris's purse sitting in the passenger side of her vehicle. She grew even more concerned at this, and at that moment, Iris's brother drove up. The two decided they should enter the room to make sure everything was okay, but they were greeted by an unwelcoming and unspeakably grisly sight. Iris Elaine Neal was lying on the bed in a pool of blood in room 22 of the Gateway Lodge Motel. She'd been badly beaten and stabbed. Iris was fully unclothed, except for a pair of moccasins. Fort Stockton police, including Chief William Quackenbush, arrived on the scene at about 6 p.m. The first thing that Chief Quackenbush took notice of was that Iris's room showed no signs of a struggle, no signs of forced entry. An autopsy later revealed that Iris Elaine Neal sustained 10 stab wounds to the chest, at least one wound piercing her heart and another her lung. Though the Odessa American reported for weeks that Iris had been stabbed in the thigh, too, and that her throat had been slit, she sustained no such wounds. And Fort Stockton's newspaper, The Pioneer, rightfully shamed them for taking it upon themselves to sensationalize the story with inaccurate details. At first, Fort Stockton Police Chief William Quackenbush would not reveal the autopsy results, declining to say if Iris had been raped. He later told the press, however, that the autopsy showed Iris had not been sexually assaulted. But Quackenbush added, "We think in terms of normalcy, but I know from experiences I had in the Bureau that many times a crime which would appear to not be sexually motivated would, when it was solved, be found to be a sex crime." The medical examiner estimated Iris's time of death as 2 a.m., the day she was found, Monday, September 3rd, 1973. The small-town police force wasn't prepared for a homicide investigation. Fort Stockton is a rather quiet, peaceful town. We're not used to murders, Quackenbush said. It was only his third day on the job, and though the former FBI special agent was a well-seasoned law enforcement officer, he'd never investigated a murder. The chief's officers, none of whom had ever investigated a crime of this violent and grisly nature, were shocked when Chief Quackenbush told the men that they had to track down every single individual who'd been at the bar where Iris was last seen. They weren't sure how they'd get it done, but they did. There are a number of persons who would have possible motives, and we have to investigate each one of those, Quackenbush said, refusing to divulge the victim's relationship to these individuals. We have got to impose a complete screen of silence for a couple days, he added. The Pecos County Sheriff's Office, Texas Highway Patrol, and the U.S. Border Patrol were aiding Fort Stockton PD in the case. D.W. Dodson, Elaine's brother, told investigators that he'd seen Elaine in a cafe the night before her body was found. She had a man over at her place from Louisiana, he told them, and the man had been drinking and was, quote, mean. A pair of brown gloves with red lining and the murder weapon, a knife, was found within a block of Iris's room. On September 9th, 6 days after the body of Iris Neal was found, Fort Stockton police announced that the knife was a relatively expensive buck knife, folding style. Police Chief Quackenbush ordered that his officers take photographs of an identical knife and identical pair of gloves and distribute the photos to law enforcement agencies in the area so they could be shown to residents and local businesses to see if anyone recognized them. We are trying to get the pictures circulated in an attempt to find someone who knows anything of this particular type of knife in the Fort Stockton area, Quackenbush told reporters. The knife alone, a fairly common knife, is not expected to produce much in the case. We have other evidence in the case, but we don't want to publicize it at this time, he added. Evidence was sent to the FBI's labs in Washington, D.C., and on September 13th, photos of the replica gloves and knife were displayed on the front page of the Fort Stockton Pioneer. Though doors were being locked, and folks had become vigilant of their surroundings and began to keep a watchful eye of others, Fort Stockton residents were cautious, but they weren't panicked or paranoid. One resident remarked that if Iris Elaine Neal had been better known in the community, perhaps the fear would be much more intense. What once seemed like an abstract and intangible occurrence to the peaceful town of Fort Stockton, something that only happens in places like Houston and Dallas, was now their reality, however, and they were fully aware of that. Though Quackenbush announced a week later that several individuals had been given polygraph tests concerning Iris's slaying, he wouldn't elaborate, saying only that no charges had been filed, no arrests made. On September 19, 1973, Chief Quackenbush told the press that his department sought a Monahans, Texas man, aged 60 to 70 years old, described as neat and respectable looking, but not as a person of interest. Rather, they sought him because he'd stayed in the room next to the room where Iris was slain a few weeks prior after his car had broken down nearby. The man who'd rented the room, police said, just handed his key to the elderly gentleman so that he could stay there for the night, after overhearing him tell the waitress at the Gateway Lodge's adjoining cafe that his van belt had split and that he was stranded till morning. Since the police were seeking a man who'd stayed in that room when Iris was killed, it is suggested that Chief Quackenbush was interested in details of that room, details of the belongings therein, though he declined to comment further on what he expected. It was a difficult case for Chief Quackenbush and his department. Since her husband died almost 7 years prior, the widow had traveled, and not just casually. She traveled often and sometimes for extended periods of time. We have to answer such questions as, with whom did she make contact with in these other towns? We're trying to piece that together. We have had considerable investigation in other states, Quackenbush said. After October 29, 1973, a little less than 2 months after Iris Elaine Neal was murdered in her one-room efficiency at the Gateway Lodge, reports on the case cease, with the exception of a brief mention in January of the following year, after Chief Quackenbush tells the Odessa American that the Fort Stockton Police Department was still awaiting the results of evidence testing at the FBI's labs in Washington, D.C. It is unknown what happened to Iris Elaine Neal in room 22 of the Gateway Lodge Motel in quiet, peaceful Fort Stockton. On Sunday, May 22, 1977, at around 8 p.m., two boys hunting rattlesnakes in a pasture in northeast Odessa near the intersection of U.S. Highway 385 and Loop 338 discovered a woman's badly decomposed body lying in a thicket of mesquite. The woman had auburn hair, was around 5 feet 3 inches tall, and weighed about 115 pounds. She wore only small black shorts, covering a bikini bottom, a single white sandal size 5.5, and a few items of jewelry. These were the only clues to the woman's identity. She wore a ring with a rectangular opal-like stone, and another that was in the shape of a horseshoe, the stones brown and rectangular as well, and a watch, the description of which wasn't elaborated on. The bikini bottom was distinct. It was black with small metal studs lining the stitching, and in front a design, two red cherries, each with a green leaf and a brown stem. A white blouse was found not too far from her body. Ector County Sheriff's investigators didn't find much on the scene, but blood found on a rock near the woman's body provided them with a possible murder weapon. Since no one in Odessa and the surrounding areas matching the description of the woman had been reported missing, the Sheriff's Department arranged for the jewelry the woman wore to be shown on local television newscasts in hopes to generate a lead. Meanwhile, Justice of the Peace Harold Sliger ruled the unknown woman's death a homicide. Her skull was broken and her jaw was smashed to pieces, Sliger described the autopsy report as showing. She was estimated to have been at the spot for about 60 days, and it couldn't be determined if the woman had been sexually assaulted. Ector County Sheriff's Office investigators were able to get her fingerprints, and, along with the dental information gathered at the autopsy, they expected a quick identification. By May 29th, 7 days after she was found, however, police were losing hope of finding anything out. The sheriff's department had exhausted the fingerprints they had on file. The jewelry shown on local television news produced tips, but no leads. An individual who wasn't affiliated with law enforcement made a drawing of the woman's distinct bikini bottom, and since the sheriff's department speculated that the garment resembled what a dancer at an adult entertainment club would wear, The individual showed his drawing to dancers at Odessa clubs, but still no one recognized it. Police again pleaded through the press for someone to come forward, and they were betting the farm that their Jane Doe was a dancer. I figure some old boy probably recalls seeing the bikini but wants to stay out of it. I can understand that, Deputy Sheriff Jim Brown told the Odessa American, adding, but we need help real bad. If they'll just come by and talk to us, we won't even ask their names. A check of missing dancers turned up nothing, too. No one could identify her. The woman was buried at Odessa Cemetery after a minister spoke a few words to a crowd that wasn't there. Then on Friday, July 8, 1977, an Ector County Sheriff's Department investigator was comparing fingerprints of the Jane Doe to prints the Odessa Police Department had on file. When the detective came across the prints of Dorothy Marie Garlington, whose prints were taken after being charged in a misdemeanor crime, he found his match. Dorothy was a 19-year-old dancer who lived in Odessa, where she danced at several different nightclubs and was known at them by her middle name, Marie. She was last seen 17 days before her body was found, but had not been reported missing. However, she had come up on the Ector County Sheriff's Department investigators' radar during their search for her identity and was one of 54 women they looked into. Dorothy had been in Odessa around 6 months and had dated several men in that time, none of whom took it upon themselves to report to police that they hadn't seen her. Dorothy was divorced, had no permanent address, and was said to have drifted around frequently. Just days before she disappeared, Dorothy Garlington was arrested for shoplifting at Gibson Discount Store. She took a mirror, bobby pins, a brush and comb set, and some makeup, less than $5 worth of goods. Dorothy typically made $4 an hour dancing at clubs. She made bond and paid a $105 fine 4 days later. The young woman was fingerprinted at the time of this arrest, the same prints that eventually led to Dorothy's body being identified. Her address at the time was in a high-crime neighborhood, the Branton Motel, where she paid $8 a day, giving police plenty to work with as far as persons of interest were concerned. Upon identifying her, Sheriff Elton Fott told the Odessa American that they had quite a number of good suspects. What would follow in the press, in the Odessa American specifically, as investigators sought Dorothy's killer, was nothing short of appalling. Dorothy Garlington was dead, and the press printed terrible quotes from people who knew her. Quotes like, "It's doubtful that Marie had a future, but if she did, someone took it from her." A fellow dancer who admitted to not liking her said of Dorothy, "Marie didn't talk to me or the other dancers, and if someone doesn't talk to me, I don't talk to them. The customers liked her, though." The owner of a bar where Dorothy often danced said about her, disgustingly, "She wasn't much to look at in the face, but she had a good body and she always had a way with the customers. The people who came in loved to watch her. She could dance." As if it wasn't enough for the Odessa American to basically speak ill of the freshly dead, it seems they ate up the chance to dislike her. Once Dorothy's identity was out as a drifting adult dancer who often resided in high-crime, seedy areas, the press had all but made up their minds about how they'd cover the progress of the investigation into her death, or, more accurately, how they'd not cover it. Even as they'd cover two other cases to redundancy and exhaustion not long after, giving daily updates of nothing for months on victims they deemed as more desirable and consumable. Little else is known about Dorothy, her life, or the investigation, or lack thereof, into who brutally bludgeoned her in the head and face, enough to crack her skull and shatter her jaw. Her father, who lived in Nederland, Texas, gave the coroner her information by phone so that he could complete the death certificate. The Odessa American phoned him then too, and he told them, quote, "I'd rather not have anything to say about it." After Dorothy Garlington was identified, Sheriff Faust told a reporter that her body would be moved once she was given her name, presumably meaning that her family would move her remains and bury them elsewhere, near them, but she never was. When her father died in 1996, Dorothy, who remains in a lonely grave in Odessa, wasn't even listed as his child. If you have any information about the murder of Dorothy Marie Garlington, please contact the Odessa Police Department at 432-333-3641. If you have any information about the murder of Anna Helen Smith, please contact the Monahans Police Department at 432-943-3254. If you have any information about the murder of Iris Elaine Neal, please contact the Fort Stockton Police Department at 432-336-4600. The Odessa American, the Fort Stockton Pioneer, and the Monahans News were used as sources for this episode. If you'd like to support Gone Cold, you can do so by donating at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. There's ad-free listening at all levels. Donations help us cover the costs of research and production, and we can't thank y'all enough for your support. Thanks for listening, y'all.